passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Welcome to today's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me, as always, is Joe Healy. We are fresh off of the first weekend of action in the 2021 college baseball season, which is super exciting to say. There are finally games that we can talk about, results on the field, as opposed to just what we think is going to happen, or even worse, what was happening in the offseason, which was, of course, a little muddled and a whole lot of nothing. So we are very excited to be able to talk about the actual games on the field. But first, I've got to let you know that the Baseball America College Podcast is presented by Rapsodo. Rapsodo has become the industry standard in player performance data. Coaches use Rapsodo data as a measuring stick for player development and evaluation. The Rapsodo National Player Database is a free service that allows you to see how you stack up against your peers and provides a pathway to get discovered by scouts. You can check out the Rapsodo National Player Database at rapsodo.com/national-database. All right, Joe, weekend one is pretty well in the books. As we sit here and record this on Monday morning, there are still a smattering of games to be played. One of the stories of the weekend was how weather affected everything, and that meant that several games got pushed back. There are teams that weren't able to start until Sunday. There are a few teams that haven't been able to start until today. But for the most part, college baseball got its opening weekend off. College baseball got its opening weekend off. And after 344 days without a college baseball game in Division I, there is nothing more that, it can excite the college baseball fan. It was a fantastic sight on Friday to have college baseball back happening live. And, Joe, I know you were excited. I was excited. It was just a great weekend to have the sport back.
Oh, my goodness. Was it ever. It was really nice to get back. I kind of pushed myself to get out to a game site this weekend just to kind of celebrate it being opening day and talk a little bit about how unique that's going to be this season. Just, I was sitting outside in no press box seating at Wake Forest because of how small that space is. And they're trying, rightfully so, to not have a bunch of people congregating in the press box. So I sat outside on, Wake's got some little, what I would describe as kind of like cocktail tables set up on the concourse. And I sat out there in the elements with my layers right down to thermal underwear and heavy socks, and then a jacket and a coat and a hat, hand warmers, all that kind of stuff. But, I kind of pushed myself to do it because I just kind of wanted to be there at a game on opening day, and it felt great. It felt cold, but it felt great. The second part of it though, was it was kind of, you and I talked about this. It was as great as it was also kind of weird because it has been 300 and whatever you said, 44 days since we've had a college baseball weekend a little more than that since a weekend, a few more days than that, but it just kind of, it was familiar in a lot of ways, but it also was, they say it's like riding a bike. This was like, we hadn't ridden a bike in 10 years, and tried to get on it, where it came back to me, but it took a little while to kind of get to the rhythms of what covering a college baseball weekend felt like, because it had just been that long. So I'm actually looking forward to the next couple of weekends, because now I feel like I kind of have my legs under me a little bit. Whereas, I don't know about you, but we had a reduced number of games this weekend because some conferences aren't starting until later and weather wiped things out and on and on and on. And yet there were times where it felt like you know, drinking from a fire hose, which is always kind of the case with, you know, the number of college baseball games we have going on a weekend. But, you know, I just felt like I was out of practice with kind of prioritizing what I should be watching at any given moment and keeping up with it all times.
Yeah, it was a bit of a soft opening on Friday because, you know, yes, like you mentioned, there are not everyone, I don't know, maybe two thirds of the teams, I wish I had an exact number, were in action this weekend in some form or fashion. But it was less than that on Friday because there was so much weather that pushed games to Saturday and off of opening day. So Friday was a nice soft landing spot, which I kind of in some ways was disappointed by because like there wasn't any college baseball on TV until 2 o'clock. There was nothing, you know, usually on opening day, you'd get minimally a noon Eastern. And usually you'd get something even ahead of that at a 10 or an 11 in the morning. And instead, it was just a very, very slow rollout, but that did make it easier to track. And then, yes, Saturday, things really started picking up from there. And it wound up being a very exciting, eventful weekend of college baseball. There's a new top 25 at baseballamerica.com. And there's a new number one already, Florida, which you know was opening a brand new ballpark in Gainesville. We thought that was, you know, going to be very exciting. And then, you know, they're playing Miami and you add the rivalry element to it and everything else. And that becomes just a huge opening weekend series. And if you listen to our podcast last week previewing the weekend, Joe and I both said that we thought Florida was going to win the series. Well, that's not what happened. Miami won. They won the rivalry series for the first time since 2014. For good measure, UCLA, which was ranked number 2 in the preseason top 25, it lost its opening weekend series to San Francisco. And Texas Tech went 0-2 in the first two games of the tournament in Arlington. And all of that meant that there was a wide open spot at the top of the top 25 after the first weekend of the season for the second year in a row. And Ole Miss is very happy to occupy that number one spot now for the first time in program history after an impressive start down in Arlington. They're 2-0. We'll say this a few more times on the podcast. There's still games today, and the State Farm College Baseball Showdown in Arlington is one of them. So we'll see what Ole Miss does being number one in a hurry. But we have this new top 25. We're very excited to talk about that and to talk about, you know, just the various games from around the country this weekend. So Joe, there are a lot of places we can start. To me though, the two big things here are Miami upsetting Florida and what Ole Miss has done so far in Arlington. So where do you want to start this?
I think we should start with Florida and Miami. And full disclosure, I was going to atone for the fact that, you know, we really downplayed Miami's chances, even though kind of at the end we circled back on like, you know, but this could be a competitive series. You know, Miami does have the talent to get it done. You know, we spent a lot of time talking about why it couldn't happen. So to atone for that, what I had planned on doing was to make up for it, I was going to do a full-throated C-A-N-E-S Canes chant. however, my wife is on a call in the other room with some, you know, some big bosses at her job. And so that probably would not be the kind of background noise she's looking for in an important meeting. So I will not be doing the C-A-N-E-S Canes chant, although maybe at a podcast to come, I'll give them something like that. But
hopefully the listeners can just imagine you throwing up the U.
Yeah, there you go. Just do that. I'm actually wearing a turnover chain right now, too.
Is that still a thing?
I think they do. Yeah, they do a new one every year, I think. I think it's kind of a big deal that they kind of have like a new version for each season. And, you know, I got to say, I think it speaks to the how good an idea the turnover chain was in its inception, that there's been a lot of copycats of that in college football. And the turnover chain is one of the ones that has really kind of stuck. So I think it speaks to that was a good idea. A lot of the copycats, however, were not.
And they turn over just, backpack.
Right. Just for one example. Yes. So, but no, the Florida Miami series, you know, you and I talked yesterday offline and I said, you know, with the exception of the Sunday game, which, you know, Miami jumps out to a really quick lead on Hunter Barco, not a great day for Hunter Barco. And then Florida actually does a really nice job clawing back in, hits like a bunch of atom balls in the last couple innings of the game. You know, there's a line drive double play to first, and I think it was the eighth, where if that ball's 2 feet to either side, it might tie the game. You know, there was some of that late. So could have gone a different direction. And it seemed like this is the way that series goes, as Miami loses that game in heartbreak. It seems like the logical endpoint of this rivalry being heartbreaking for Miami. But so take that comeback out of it. And then if you had role reversed Florida and Miami with how the first two games went and then the beginning of the third game, and you told me that was the way it was going to play out with those roles reversed, I would have believed you, because we've read that story before. You know, we've seen the movie where Miami wins a game, whether it's on Friday or on Saturday, and it feels like a pretty comprehensive win. And okay, you feel pretty good. And then they lose the other game in extra innings in heartbreaking fashion, and they were oh so close. And then in the third game, Florida just boat races them. So it felt like that's actually, we were heading for a complete role reversal. Florida had making that comeback kind of upset that apple cart a little bit. But I also don't want to downplay how well Miami played in certain aspects. Certainly the offense showed a little bit, you know, when you're getting good production from guys like Tony Jenkins and Christian Del Castillo, the Seton Hall transfer. And I think Raymond Gill, who had a really tough year last year, was productive this weekend, clutch in a lot of ways. I think that speaks highly of what the Miami offense is capable of and the depth they might have there. However, I think you will agree that in a lot of ways, Miami just kind of didn't play quite as sloppy as Florida in a lot of ways, which is surprising that Florida, you know, kind of a sloppy game for Florida. And that's kind of what made the difference, because it just, after Friday, when Florida played good defense, pitched pretty well. I mean, the bullpen got a little wonky at the end, and it made the game, that made that game closer than it truly was. But after that, I mean, Florida, three errors Friday and Saturday, bullpen meltdown on Saturday, really bad start from Hunter Barco on Sunday. Like, it just did not look anything like the Florida team I expected to see this weekend.
So I guess going back to what we said coming into the weekend, when I brought us back to the idea that, you know, Miami did lose three close games in this series a year ago, it's not inconceivable that they could go up to Gainesville and win. What I said was they needed a better offensive performance. They scored 8 runs in this series at Mark Light last year. Well, they definitely brought the offense with them to Gainesville. They course corrected on that in a big way. And, you know, that was really significant for the Canes to do it against Florida pitching, which, you know, we still think this weekend aside that this is one of the best, if not the best, pitching staffs in the entire country. So for Miami to swing the bats the way they did this weekend, that was huge, because this is a much younger, inexperienced, I guess, pitching staff. The rotation is completely new. Daniel Fetterman is a veteran on Friday night, but he has been mostly a reliever throughout his career. Now he's being asked to be a starter. And then Miami threw two freshmen, Alejandro Rosario and Victor Medeiros, who are both incredibly highly ranked coming in as freshmen. They were both top 75 draft prospects a year ago, but they are still freshmen. There's going to be some growing pains there. And then with Fetterman moving out of the bullpen, there's some new roles to be had in relief. So there was just a lot new about this pitching staff. And while they pitched well throughout the weekend, the Florida offense definitely got its runs in, and it's a really good offense, and that's to be expected. But Miami is going to need its offense to keep clicking. That's the strength of this team right now. By the end of the season, maybe it'll be a little more balanced. But right now, like, the clear strength is an offense that features Alex Toral, Adrian Del Castillo, Jordan Lala, like Villar, Yohandy Morales looked amazing as a freshman. You can just keep running down. It's a really deep lineup, and they needed it to produce, and that's what they did. So on the Miami side, to me, that is like the number one thing that stood out to me. When I talked to Gino DeMari yesterday, his other thing beyond the offense, which he gave a lot of credit to his assistant coach, Noberto Lopes, just for helping Miami get it worked out right now. The other thing Gino mentioned, though, was just that the finishing of this team the last few years, especially in 2019, his first as a head coach, we didn't really get a good sense for what the 2020 team was in terms of how they were going to close out games and series, although I will say it didn't go well against Florida last year. It's been a bugaboo. And so for them to show the fight that they showed this weekend and then come back and finish the games, finish the series, get a series win in a rivalry that they haven't won the series in since 2014, that really speaks a lot about where Miami is, just kind of in a mental place going into this season. So big time for them. On the Florida side, I wrote on Friday that if this is where Florida is right now, they are like, you should be, any other team should be really kind of concerned about how good the Gators will be at the end of the season, because this is a team that has an incredible amount of talent, but still has a ton of growth ahead of it. And that take maybe looks a little worse today than it did on Friday night, but they were so close to winning the series on Saturday. They had a 3-run lead in the 9th inning in game 2. If they just close that game out, they win the series, and I can go back and feel very confident about saying, like, look, if this is where Florida is now, with all this talent and all this room to grow, and, oh, by the way, they're still beating a team like Miami, which is very talented in itself, like, oh boy, look out for once they sort through some of the early season issues that they and every other team clearly has. And, you know, I still feel good about that, but I suppose that's also a bit of a charitable take that, like, look, this team that we gassed up as the clear national title favorites, like, they are not where they need to be right now. Defensively, it was a bad weekend. That was true across the sport, however. I don't want to harp on it on Florida because defense around the country was not good this weekend. And frankly, that's not that surprising. A similar thing happened over the summer. So it's going to take these teams a little while to get the gloves back, I think. Defense wasn't good. The bullpen, which we lauded as being the best in the country, clearly hasn't worked things out. Franco Alamon couldn't find the strike zone in the 9th inning on Saturday. I felt like he might have been getting squeezed a little bit, but regardless, it was ugly in terms of the way he lost his control. I was a little surprised that Sully stuck with him throughout the 9th. After the game, he said that he did that because, you know, that if that's going to be Alamon's role going forward, he has to learn how to get out of those jams, and what's it going to do for his confidence if he goes out and pulls him while he's struggling like that. And, you know, Sully knows a lot more about managing pitching staffs than I do. So I'll defer to him on that for sure. But it was just a little surprising to see a Florida pitcher struggle throwing strikes that much and then not have the next pitcher come in. Typically there's a little less patience, I feel like. And some of that is just that it's opening weekend and Sully's trying to figure things out. He does this all the time early in the season, gives his players a lot of leash and figures out what they can and can't do and then tightens it up from there. So, you know, it's also a little wonky that this was an opening weekend series, because this is a huge series, but it didn't seem like Sully was going to manage it any differently just because it was a rivalry. He's still looking at it as like, look, we need to figure out what we have here and prepare for SEC play and beyond. So, you know, there's a lot there, Joe. I don't know if you want to go off of any of that. If you have more you want to say, I watched a lot of this series over the weekend, and I clearly have thoughts.
Indeed. Well, yeah, there's a lot to it. Like, it just had a lot of layers. I would say quickly too on that, I don't, you know, Florida, I think, will end up focusing more on Florida's bullpen struggles because they were so, like, clear in the moment, you know, with what Franco Alamon, what happened to him on Saturday, and then even on Friday, which let Miami get a little bit back into it. But, you know, Miami is kind of in the same boat where, I mean, outside of Carson Palmquist, which Florida had its own version of Carson Palmquist, and that was Christian Scott, who was pretty good both times he threw. But Carson Palmquist was excellent. Ben Wanger got some big outs, but like his innings were kind of like white knuckle. They were not the cleanest of innings. You know, he's an experienced guy you trust. Like he's one of their older players. And so I assume he'll continue.
But this is his first year in Miami and in the ACC. Spent most of his, spent 4 years at Yale and then transferred to USC last year and now is in Miami.
Yeah. And was, you know, was pretty good last year at USC, but was more of a hitter. Like he was actually a little bit more of an impact player on offense than he was last year than pitching. I mean, it was just a small sample pitching wise. I think he saved a bunch of games, but it was all pretty short stints. But anyway, so I think Miami has questions to answer too, bullpen wise, because, you know, like I said, Palmquist, okay, great. But outside of that, like you looked at what happened on Sunday where it just felt like nobody was really, you know, and some of that is just Florida was clearly feeling it at the end of that game and they were going to make their comeback and that was just going to happen. But every game was a little bit like that where Miami was just kind of desperately cycling through relievers, trying to find somebody to settle things down. And it felt like they really didn't find a ton yet. So, and again, it's a young, relatively young pitching staff, a lot of guys in new roles. So there is time for that. But I think it would be easy to kind of say, well, Florida's bullpen faltered and Miami was a little bit steadier. And I just don't think it's quite that simple. Miami had their own struggles out there for sure.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a good point. And both of these teams have a ton of guys that they just have to sort through and figure out who they can trust in what roles and who fits best where. And that's going to take some time. And that's another thing that you heard from around the country, just the managers or the coaches are having to manage a little more than they're used to because the rosters are deeper. And right now they didn't get to see fall games against outside competition. Everyone had a little bit of a strange fall, just even at baseline, even if they, you know, it wasn't that long ago that you didn't see fall games against outside competition. So even if you revert back to that, like your fall was still a little bit wonky at best. And you know, so it's just going to take a little bit of time to figure all of this out in the best of circumstances. And then, you know, you look at a Miami that has a, you know, just a lot of new faces on the pitching staff. It's going to take probably even a little more time. But for Miami, can't say enough about what this series win means. That at least just mentally, you know, I don't know what it feels like to not beat your rival since 2014 in a series, but I'm sure that weighs on the program to an extent, and they now have at least broken that streak and can part of Gino DeMare's remit. This is true of Mike Martin Jr. at Florida State as well. Part of what they need to do is to find a way to get the rivalry with Florida back on more level ground because the Gators, and this shouldn't be a surprise, just given the way the Gators dominated so much of the sport for the last decade. I mean, you can make a case that they were the team of the 2010s. The case is also to be made for Vanderbilt, but it's probably one of those two teams. And you know, I don't want to get sidetracked on the is it South Carolina? We've probably had this discussion on the podcast. The point is that, you know, Florida has been one of the best teams in college baseball for the last decade plus. So it should be no surprise then that Florida has also owned that state for the last decade plus. And Miami and Florida State need to find a way to stop that. And maybe this was the start of something for Miami. Maybe it wasn't. But minimally, I think that they have to be waking up today feeling a little bit better about where they are, having gone up and won that series in Gainesville. All right, we're going to move on from here. Get to some talk about that college baseball showdown in Arlington and what the Ole Miss Rebs did to move up to number one in the rankings. But first, check this out. Okay, Joe, Ole Miss is the kind of standout from the college baseball showdown just because they are 2-0 and now number one in the top 25. But can't ignore what Arkansas has done, going 2-0 there to start the weekend as well. I think you were a little more locked into this than I was. I was a little more locked into Florida and Miami. We'll get into why that might have been later on. But first, what have you thought of what Ole Miss has done down there in Arlington?
Yeah, really impressive stuff. Kind of just a continuation of what we saw from Ole Miss last year. My lasting impression of Ole Miss from last year was what they did at the LeClaire Classic. Now, that was not their final weekend of the season. It was next to last, but came away really impressed with what they did out there, where they were clearly the class of that tournament, which included teams not as good as these they're seeing this weekend, but still pretty good competition there. But I think it's we talked about this a little bit leading up to the weekend, where it's hard to pin down exactly why teams have success or don't have success in tournaments like this. You know, and we can talk about that a little bit when we start to talk about Texas Tech is 0-2, for example, and how it's just kind of hard to imagine that, you know, but there are reasons for it, but also it kind of feels a little bit random sometimes. But I think what Ole Miss gives you is a certain level of balance where they can kind of win games in a lot of different ways. And I think that's what you've kind of seen, where, you know, their game against TCU, which is the first game they played, it turns into a bullpen game like in 5 minutes. You know, Nikhazy gets hit around a little bit, walks some guys. He can't get out the second inning. On the other side, they knock TCU's Johnny Ray out after 3 innings. So turns into a bullpen game. Okay, no problem. Jackson Kimbrell, Drew McDaniel, Taylor Broadway, they're going to throw the last 7 1/3 innings without allowing, you know, TCU to really get much of anything going. You know, it was a little bit similar in the second game where the bullpen had to throw some innings late to try to hold on to a lead. But in that game, they got a little more from Gunnar Hoglund, where it was like, okay, now we're going to win a game because our guy really just kind of shoves. So Gunnar Hoglund gave up a few runs, but struck out 11 in 5 1/3 innings. And while maybe you wondered a little bit about the offense, if you were concerned about Anthony Servideo or about Tyler Keenan being gone from the lineup, you had to have liked what you saw from a guy like Jacob Gonzalez, who came in and has immediately announced himself as, okay, this guy has the look of the next big star in this program. So it's just a really solid weekend. I mean, nothing really super stands out about it. They're not blowing teams out, but that's more than you can say for a lot of the rest of the field here. Even, you know, Arkansas, who is also 2-0 in this tournament, I've come away more impressed with what Ole Miss has done versus with what Arkansas has done, because, you know, Arkansas wins just an ugly, ugly, weird, wild game. You have to give their offense credit for winning that game against Texas Tech 13-9, because they score 5 runs in the ninth to go from 9-8 down to 13-9 up. And that's impressive in its own way. And they pitch well in the Sunday game against Texas, but, you know, Texas has been through a lot between not having been able to practice for much of the last week plus now because of the weather situation in Central Texas. It already had offensive questions. Like, I'm not taking anything away from guys like Peyton Paulette or Caleb Bolden, who pitched really well on Sunday, but it remains to be seen, like, how impressed we can really be with that over Texas. So if you're asking me which is more impressive, I think I'd probably go Ole Miss, just because they've kind of shape-shifted their way to winning these first two games. They don't have anybody who's just pitching out of their minds necessarily. There's not anybody who, you know, went 8-for-10 over the weekend and really carried the offense. They're getting a lot from a lot of different places. And I think that really bodes well for its ability to have some staying power as the number one team in the country. Whether or not they stay number one long-term is a different question, but this strikes me as a team that's not going to just fade.
Yeah. So the thing that stands out to me from Ole Miss is that their offense has been fine this weekend. Like, if you go look at some numbers, they aren't great. I don't want to, you know, impugn them, though. They're facing really good pitching staffs that in these games down there. The starting rotation was supposed to be the really strong point about this Rebs team. Not the reason why they were number four, but if you told me pick the best thing about Ole Miss, I probably would have said the rotation. Well, Nikhazy, who has been one of the most reliable pitchers in college baseball the last couple of years, that's a guy that was on the collegiate national team in 2019 after his freshman season, he has one of his worst starts on Saturday. And then Hoglund, who's a preseason All-American, potential first-round pick, probably projected first-round pick, actually, not even just potential, he really stands out because of the way he controls the baseball. He walks 3 guys in 5 1/3. Like, yeah, he struck out 11 and that's great. But like, his whole thing is that he doesn't walk people. Like, that's been his thing going back to high school. I think he walked like 3 guys in his final 2 seasons of high school. something absolutely crazy like that. Maybe it was three walks in the senior year in Florida high school, not in some like lesser high school baseball state, in Florida high school baseball. So that was surprising. But you know what's been awesome though is their bullpen. Bullpen has been fantastic. Taylor Broadway was fantastic on Saturday, and things got a little dicey at the end of Sunday's game, but they got it done. And you know, now they're looking at, you know, through two games, Braden Forsyth and Taylor Broadway, their top two relievers, two veterans at the back of the bullpen, both have saves, and you know, things look really good back there when you consider what Kimbrel and Broadway and Forsyth have done so far, and the fact that Mike Bianco has given some of the younger guys a shot back there, I think is encouraging as well. So to me, that's the standout thing about Ole Miss, in addition to Jacob Gonzalez, who has been fantastic. He was Ole Miss's best hitter in the fall statistically, and that's carrying over. Only Hayden Dunhurst has better numbers right now than Gonzalez through two games. And eventually, you know, the rest of the lineup's going to get going. I don't even want to say that they're not going right now. Again, it's tough competition and it's two games. So I think that it's very impressive what Ole Miss has done. They've now won 18 straight games going back to last year. That's a program record that previously dated to 1960. And they're now number one in the Baseball America Top 25 for the first time in the rankings history, and those go back 40 years. So it's a crazy, impressive run that Ole Miss is on here. And you know, I mean, we thought they were the SEC West favorites coming into the year. Thought they were Omaha, you know, contenders slash favorites. It's a big time look to start the season like that and to back up those kinds of predictions.
You know, I started to talk about it a little bit, but Texas Tech being 0-2 is a little bit of a surprise for me, because kind of what Ole Miss has done the first couple of days is kind of what I thought Texas Tech could do. And it's why I feel like they can play well in tournaments like this, because they've, you know, sometimes the games get uglied up, but they typically find a way to win those games. They nearly did against Ole Miss. You alluded to it, but the Sunday game was like, had Texas Tech pulled that comeback off, that is like a kind of a stereotypical Texas Tech win, where it's like, they don't really look like they should win the game for much of the day, but offense kind of figures it out and comes back in the end. And it's, you know, it's a lot of role players just doing little things here and there to get them there. But Ole Miss held them at bay. But I think you saw on Friday in the 13-9 loss to Arkansas for Texas Tech, I think you kind of saw, you know, you and I talk about Texas Tech's kind of mix and match approach on the mound. And sometimes we talk about it in a positive light, like, hey, you know, look at how many just like big time, you know, big arms, like guys who can, you know, mid 90s with big breaking balls or what have you, they can just throw at you guy after guy after guy until they find someone who is feeling it. And then sometimes we talk about it derisively, where we say like, oh, you just don't know what to expect with Texas Tech. And I think you saw in that first game against Arkansas kind of what happens when they're cycling through guys and they just cannot for the life of them find the guy. You know, they got a good start from, you know, the Seton Hill transfer, Patrick Monteverde. I mean, four
it's
innings.
Seton Hill, not Seton Hall.
Correct, yes.
D3 in Pittsburgh, as opposed to the Pirates of New Jersey.
Indeed. Yeah, I actually had a thought when I was – so I watched the start of that game, and then I ended up flipping to some other stuff once it kind of got uglied up and the pace slowed to a crawl. But so I was watching him start that game, and, you know, he's pitching in Globe Life Field in Arlington against – you know, a team in Arkansas that's a national title contender. And so then out of curiosity, I was like, man, this is a big moment for me. And out of curiosity, I went and like just Googled what Seton Hill's like home baseball field looks like. And I imagine that like a year ago he was pitching on that mound, and now he's pitching at Globe Life Field against Arkansas. Just amazing kind of transition there in that young man's life. And he threw the ball well. But after that, oh boy, you know, Brandon Birdsall really struggled with his control. Ryan Sublette, who's been kind of a steady Eddie pitcher for them, four runs in two innings, and Andrew Devine, five runs in two thirds of an inning. It just was not super pretty for Texas Tech. And then, you know, Devine ends up being the guy who kind of wears it, you know, where Arkansas you know, puts those five runs on him in the ninth inning. But it just was not a super pretty game there. Now, the second game was a little bit different, but the troubling part for Texas Tech is like, okay, Brennan Gurton threw a good game, and then, you know, a couple guys after him threw good innings of relief, but it was Micah Dallas who ended up wearing it. And that's not great either, because they're really going to need him, whether it's in a extended relief role as an opener or as just a legit starter. They're going to need him at some point, and he'll figure it out, I'm sure. But it certainly was not a great first impression this season that, you know, he allowed a five-run inning, three of those runs unearned. So that's worth noting, but it was just not a good outing for him in any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, I don't know what to make of Texas Tech right now. I don't know if we got overexcited and ranking them number three. I don't know if this is just, you know, they had a tough week. I imagine there was a lot of snow in Lubbock, but I don't know. And or is this just a case of like, look at all the new things on the pitching staff? Like, it's just going to take a while. It takes Texas Tech sometimes a while anyway. And like, now look at all of the new toys they have on the pitching staff. Look at how they have to replace the top two starters. Like, what are they going to do? I don't know where we're at with the Red Raiders. It's also possible it was just two tough games. They'll come back, they'll win this third game, and like, okay, they had a losing weekend on opening weekend. It happens. So it's really hard for me to, you know, kind of try and figure out where the Red Raiders are at right now. And I honestly don't even want to spend that much energy trying to do it. I just want to see what it looks like moving forward, because the one certainty I have about Texas Tech is that whatever it looks like right now, at least on the pitching staff, this is not the way it's going to look in April. So if we could just fast forward through Texas Tech figuring out how it's going to line up its pitching staff, that would be great. It would save me a whole lot of headache in terms of trying to figure out where to rank them and what their ultimate potential is.
I guess we'll quickly kind of round it out here. Texas, we've talked about a little bit, and we've talked about the reasons why maybe they've struggled a little bit. It was always going to be a pitching over offense team, most likely, but, you know, you don't get a great start from Ty Madden to start it off. You know, you're shifting things around because Pete Hansen's not ready to be the starter that you kind of hoped he would be for COVID protocol reasons, and just not being as prepped as they would like him to be. So that threw things off a little bit for the Longhorns, and they've struggled to just score runs. And so it's been a tough weekend for them, but just getting back into the swing of things, I think they'll get better. Dustin McComas on Twitter, who covers the Longhorns locally, you know, talked about on Thursday, or maybe it was Wednesday, but, you know, he was maybe saying that if I were the Longhorns, I don't know that I would play this weekend, because they can't be physically prepared. And so now, in light of that, I think they've actually done a pretty decent job competing. But it's clear that they've been just a little step off this weekend. I've been pretty impressed with Mississippi State. They did lose a game to TCU, which I think was a really nice win for TCU. They got a double play ball in the ninth inning with the bases loaded and one out to seal that 3-2 win. But, you know, Mississippi State is short Eric Sarantola this weekend. But they've got it down the mound. They've 250 ERA for the weekend. Landon Sims did basically what Taylor Broadway did for Ole Miss, but for Mississippi State in that Texas game, struck out 10.
He did it better, to be clear.
Yeah, he was dominant. You know, Taylor Broadway
don't add us, Hail State fans.
Yeah. Yeah, Landon Sims was nothing short of 4 no-hit innings, 10 strikeouts, you know, no walks. I mean, it just an incredible, incredible outing there. But, you know, Christian McLeod was pretty solid, gave up some hits, but did what he needed to do in the first start. And offensively, if you look through the prism of offenses in this tournament, with the notable exception, I guess, of Arkansas's big explosion, and I guess to a certain degree Texas Tech on the first day, like it hasn't been the most offensive weekend there. And so through that prism, they're actually hitting the ball pretty well in the grand scheme of things. So I've actually, even though they're 1-1, I've come away fairly impressed with Mississippi State and what their upside is, especially once they get a full rotation back in the mix.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. Interesting to see what they and TCU have going forward, particularly. I like you, don't know what to make of Texas right now. It was a really hard week. You saw the pictures from Austin. I don't know. I don't know what the right call was in terms of playing, not playing. I certainly understand it either way. So they went, they did it. I'm sure they'll be better for it, even though the record right now doesn't reflect that. Joe, you and I had this conversation slightly offline, but I want to bring it to a larger audience here. Typically, you know, throughout my career in this job, I have not really missed the big tournament, the big tournament, really ever in the last 5 years. You know, I've been at the Minute Maids. I, you know, when the tournament in LA is the big deal, I'm there. This year, though, I'm not a Globe Life, obviously. And I kind of found it a little off my radar, frankly. And that was surprising because in previous years, whether it's like the MLB 4 tournament or, you know, the Shriners College Classic in Houston, I've just always felt like, oh, this is the biggest thing going. And like, yeah, this is absolutely it. Like this is what college baseball is paying attention to. And if there was ever a tournament like that, it was definitely this one, which had six of the top 15 teams playing on opening weekend. And yet, so many times this weekend, I found myself not watching these games, watching something else. So I have a few theories as to why that might be. It's probably a combination of all of them, but just wanted to run them by you and see what you think, because you know, you've been both at some of these big tournaments and also watching them more as a fan from at home. So maybe you can help me understand why this happened to me. So the number one reason I think that this happened is because they delayed it until Saturday. And so by the time it started, I was just already into weekend mode and they felt like they were a day behind. And I, you know, I was already invested in other things. And now here, this new thing was coming along and I was like, well, I got other things here. I don't need this. And, you know, so they just kind of put themselves in a little bit of an attention hole that way. Number two, you had to leave the ESPN app to go find this thing. You know, it being on Flow Sports meant that the ecosystem I was watching it in was a little bit different. So that was maybe a little bit strange. And then, you know, those are probably the two big ones for me. But, you know, there also may just be something to like the fact that, you know, I got sucked into a very competitive series between Florida and Miami, and Florida has a number one next to its name. So, you know, when the number one team is playing very competitive games, like I just feel compelled to watch them because you know, that feels hyper important that look, the number one team might lose this weekend. I need to watch and be ready to write about that more than I need to, you know, focus on something that is just frankly really sprawling. And I feel how sprawling it is when I'm at the games, but then you realize the fact that you have to watch three of these really high profile games in succession from home. Like, honestly, that's even worse than being at the games. I felt like just in terms of keeping your attention for all that time. So all of those reasons I feel like contributed to this falling behind in terms of my like TV pecking order. But you know, I don't know what to make of that, but that's where I was this weekend.
I think they're all valid. I think you're right that it's just a lot of contributing death by a thousand cuts situation. But I think all of those are, I wouldn't disagree with any of what you said. I think it all contributes. I will say, so the ESPN thing is having to go specifically to Flow Sports, like unless you're just a fan of one of these programs where you weren't going to miss it anyway, like that is an extra step. And it is easy. I know from experience, like let's say a Florida Miami game ends, it's real easy on that ESPN app to just hit the back button and then scroll whatever's on. And so you're right that having to go back out to Flow Sports is like one extra step that kind of can create some friction there with you continuing to watch that tournament. I, by the way, I was pretty impressed by the production at Flow Sports. Like this is my first experience with Flow Sports, and I know Flow Sports has its detractors. It is a little bit pricey. You know, if you're going month to month, it's $30 a month. And also, like, I had heard a lot of people that kind of complained about the quality of it, but I found, you know, it's different from tournament to tournament. There's not going to be as much production quality behind the Snowbird baseball tournament in Florida as there is in the State Farm College Baseball Showdowns. That's part of it. But I came away pretty impressed with the product.
I'm interested.
So it worked all weekend.
The CAA has all of its conference games on Flow Sports, and I'll be interested to see what the quality of those games is like.
Yeah. Yeah, I would presume it's pretty locally driven, though, too.
Probably,
right?
Yeah.
It's kind of whatever equipment the school has available and whatever production resource the school has available will drive a lot of that. But also, like, you know, our lives are very app driven these days. And so if the app just works like it's supposed to, like you score a lot of points with me, and like to Flow Sports' credit, it never crashed on me. Like I never had like these weird buffering issues or lagging or really anything like it. And some of that is just based on how good your internet is. I get that, but the app itself worked pretty doggone well. So I was pretty pleased with that. But the other things I would say is, you know, so using the Minute Maid tournament as the example, I went to that tournament for a lot of years as a fan. I was paying money to be there. And yet my friends and I who would go to this tournament when we were in high school and in college, we even kind of joked about how, you know, the middle game kind of gets short shrift in a lot of ways because we'd be all excited for the first game. We'd pay a lot of attention to it. And then our energy would just inevitably lag like in the middle game. And then we'd kind of have to snap out of it, you know, as that game is wrapping up to get ready for whatever the night game was mentally. And I just think that happens when you've got those three games stacked on top of each other. And oh, by the way, you alluded to it, you know, the defense isn't necessarily the crispest. They're being super careful with pitchers. So there's a lot of pitching changes. Even in the games that were low scoring, there were a lot of pitching changes. The pace was just not good in a lot of cases. And so I think it's hard to like watch those three games and pay close attention to them stacked on top of each other like that, because I think the other reality is I am super guilty of this. So I will raise my hand on this one. But I also think sometimes it's easy to convince yourself that I'm going to pay really close attention to this tournament this weekend. And maybe I don't watch all nine games, but I'm going to pay close attention to like four or five of them. And then I'll zoom in and out on the others while I'm watching other stuff. And the reality of the situation is it's just hard to do that. Like it's hard to really devote your attention at a super high level of detail for multiple games stacked on top of each other that day. So if you're watching Florida Miami super close, it's just going to be hard to flip over to a different game and pay that much attention for 3.5 more hours on top of that. So I'm guilty of kind of being disappointed in myself that certain things just fly by my radar, but I just think it's almost beyond human capability in a lot of cases for us to really pay that level of attention to multiple games every single day.
Yeah, I think there's probably a lot to that. And you know, it's three games a day is a lot. It's a lot when you're in the stadium. It's a lot when you're at home. It is just a lot. It's a fun tournament. I'm glad that it was as great as it was in terms of the teams in the field, but it is a lot. And it felt even more than it would have if I was there, probably because if I was there, I would not have been anywhere close to as locked in on Florida and Miami as I wound up being.
Well, it's also when you're there, you also can't, even if you put headphones on, which we've all, working those tournaments, we've all done that where you put headphones on because you're trying to focus on something else or you're trying to write something or whatever. But even that, with that, like you can't not at least peripherally know what's going on in the game in front of you. I don't know about you, but it's real easy for me. Like if I'm focused on something else on my laptop and I've got a game on the TV, like if I'm trying to focus more on the laptop, like I'll turn the volume down a few ticks and then you look up and it's like three innings later. You just can't really do that when you're there because crowd noise and PA noise and the people around you making some noise or moving around. Like, so you can really just kind of ignore things a lot easier when you're here versus when it's happening right in front of you.
Oh yeah. I have a mute button and I am not afraid to use it.
Yeah.
That doesn't exist when I'm at a game. Much as you might like it to at times, it does not. Looking at you, Vanderbilt. Let's move on from here. I mentioned at the top briefly that UCLA lost to San Francisco in a series. That was weird. That was a surprise. San Francisco was 9-8 last season. Now, they were probably a little better than that record indicates. They got hot at the end of the season. They won a series against Cal. Now, Cal wasn't good. particularly at all last season, but they did win a series against a Pac-12 team last year and won like six of their last seven games. But the Dons were picked by West Coast Conference coaches. They tied for fifth in the preseason coaches poll. So they weren't expected to be good by their own conference's coaches this year. We didn't pick them any better than that when Joe did the West Coast Conference preview. So not like we saw this coming any more than the coaches did, but they go out, they win twice at Jackie Robinson Stadium. They won on Friday night. They come back, UCLA comes back and takes the rubber game, and then San Francisco wins the third game. None of the three games were particularly close. They were all pretty one-sided generally. It was kind of a comprehensive series win by the Dons from what I can establish. You know, it's not what we thought at all UCLA was going to be like. If you listen to the podcast, like, a couple of weeks ago with John Savage, obviously he didn't think his team was likely to lose on opening weekend either. I didn't get that vibe. UCLA was without Zach Pettway, as Savage told us. He's a little behind. They're being a little cautious with him coming off of some offseason injury stuff. But just being down Pettway should not have been the difference in this series. And I'm not even saying that it was. San Francisco just seemed like they were a little bit better. It was a weird weekend out west. You can look through a whole lot of results and get kind of confused as to what happened out there. So maybe things are just, there's just more parity out west than we realized. I knew there was going to be some. I didn't know it was going to be preseason Pac-12 favorite getting upset by middle of the pack preseason's picked West Coast Conference team. And it's opening weekend. I don't want to jump to crazy conclusions here either. Teams have bad weekends. They get magnified on opening weekend. But at the same time, this was not the UCLA team I signed up for when I picked them to go to Omaha, or when we ranked them number two in the country.
Yeah, the UCLA series loss to San Francisco was probably just the most shocking result of the weekend, because while we were surprised Miami won the series against Florida, it was Miami, a top 15 Miami team winning a series against Florida. Like, okay.
Well, and what do you do with the records in a rivalry series, Joe?
That's right. You throw them out. That's right. That's absolutely right. Great point.
And you can throw the rankings out too while you're at it.
That's right. Yeah. Great point by you. But the thing about it is having Zach Pettway not available for UCLA was it hurt, because you turn that start over to Jared Karros and he was not particularly good. He wasn't awful, but it wasn't particularly good. But it went beyond that, to your point. Jesse Bergen in the second game was exactly what you needed from him. Great start. But outside of that, nothing really went according to plan. I mean, Nick Nastrini was just kind of okay. Like, he dominated in the strikeouts, but that San Francisco hit him around a little bit. I think the strangest thing is that San Francisco tagged Kyle Mora, and nobody hits Kyle Mora. That's just, he's as steady as anybody, in the country in terms of bullpen pitchers. And then offensively, UCLA hit .218. Now, you can't blame Matt McClain. He went 5-for-11 this weekend. But other than that, pretty slow weekend offensively for UCLA to hit .218 against San Francisco. And I know this is going to be easy for me to say right now, but San Francisco was a team when I was doing the WCC preview that I struggled most with. I think most teams, I'll put an initial order together, and then most teams will move up or down one spot, maybe two, after I've kind of written everybody up. And, because it's, you give an initial order, then after you write the teams up, you can kind of almost see how you really feel about them. And so you move them around a little bit. Well, San Francisco might have moved up and down four spots at various points, because what I will say about them is they do have the pitchers to give you a hard time. And so I think that's kind of what we saw here this weekend in a lot of cases, because they do have some arms out there, some guys with high velocity. They have a very experienced pitching staff. So I would not have been surprised if this series ended up being low scoring, because San Francisco pitched well enough to make it competitive. But the fact that San Francisco, to your point, just completely outplayed them, it seemed like, in the two wins, was a big time surprise to me. And the West Coast in general was kind of bonkers this weekend. And I think the other thing to add onto the pile, and pardon me if you mentioned it, but it's just that I think the West Coast is going to take a while to shake out because of just how disjointed everything on the West Coast has been. When you talk about, you know, the fall practice, some teams not having it, some teams had it, some teams kind of were in the middle somewhere. And then the same thing with the lead up to the season, you know, and there are West Coast teams that haven't, plenty of West Coast teams haven't played yet just because of scheduling situations. So I think it's going to take a little while before the West Coast feels normal in terms of what results we're getting, are getting spit out, because certainly week one was not it in terms of what we expected.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. You saw beyond this, you saw Arizona lose 2 of 3 to Ball State. They play a fourth today, so the Wildcats will get a chance to at least split the series. You saw Pepperdine, the West Coast Conference favorite, lose a series to Cal Baptist. UCSB lost on opening day. Arizona State lost on opening day. Both of those teams rebounded to win the series, but you know, still those were expected to be two of the better teams, and they lost. I think your point about how difficult the offseason was for teams out there is a very important one. Nowhere in the country, I don't think, had stricter regulations or more disparate regulations than California, going county by county. The thing about that, though, at least as it pertains to UCLA, is that UCLA actually had a fall practice. This wasn't like, you know, a Long Beach State, which didn't have a fall practice. It wasn't like them getting upset. It was a team that had one of the more normal falls out that way, getting upset. So I don't know what to make of that, but that does help explain some of the general strangeness out West. There also, of course, were a lot of transfers around college baseball. And again, this doesn't really affect what happened in Westwood, although San Francisco did bring in 5 transfers this offseason. But if there was a significant amount of player movement out West, and there was, then it stands to reason that maybe there's a little more parity going into this season than you might ordinarily see. It's one weekend. We can't draw a ton of conclusions. Half of the Big West didn't even play. But right now, this is definitely something to watch. The West Coast, broadly speaking, is already kind of in RPI trouble this year, just because of how regionalized the schedules are. RPI already doesn't like how regionalized West Coast schedules are in the best of times. It's going to hate them even more this year. So again, touched on this before, hopefully the committee can look beyond RPI this year, but if it doesn't, and this is what happens all season long, do not sign the West Coast up for many at-large bids. It's just not going to happen if this is the way it's going to go down and the committee doesn't cut it a significant amount of slack. So, and it deserves the slack, I think. Although if in one of the few interregional series you have, and it's Ball State, much respect to my alma mater, but it's Ball State coming in and the team that we picked to be the second best in the Pac-12 can't get it done, like that's not speaking overly well to the conference either. And you know, a couple other wonky results out that way were Cal losing a series to Pacific. And Joe, did you catch any of Oregon State this weekend? They lose on Friday. Jordan Wicks shuts them down. No shame in that. He's a preseason All-American for a reason. But then they come back and they score like 40 runs over the next 2 days against Gonzaga in New Mexico. It was kind of a confounding weekend from the Beavers.
Yeah, I know. I did notice that. I didn't see like any of it. I didn't see any.
Yeah, I watched Friday. I did not watch the next 2 days.
Yeah, but yeah, that's, I mean, we had questions about Oregon State's offense, and I guess we'll see, you know, what becomes of Gonzaga and New Mexico, and maybe that gives us some good context later on. But what I will say is that it's all the right guys. You look at the stat sheet, and it's like, it's Troy Klontz, and it's Andy Armstrong, and it's Kyler McMahon, and it's Ryan Ober, and it's like, okay, well, those were the guys we kind of assumed would be leading the way if they were able to get it done. So I think that was a real positive weekend in that regard for Oregon State, and kind of feels like maybe they moved into pole position for now, in terms of like maybe they're the team that that kind of works their way into the postseason discussion from the Pac-12. But I think since we're talking about the West Coast, I think we have delayed talking about the biggest story of the weekend long enough. What the hell happened in San Diego?
You probably have the numbers up. Explain.
Yes,
explain the situation in San Diego State and San Diego, which low key, like we didn't talk about it last week on the podcast. I think Joe told me that he considered picking it as his series for us to focus on. I didn't give it enough. Like I short shrifted it until I realized too late that like it could have been one of the best pitching matchups on Friday night. It wound up not being quite as good as it was from a scouting, quite as good as it could have been from a scouting perspective, because San Diego, the way they aligned the rotation. But you know, these are two teams that have some significant arms. You look at Troy Melton for San Diego State and Jake Miller and Rustad, their USD. So what on paper looks like a well-pitched series, instead Joe turns into what?
Oh Jesus. Just like a so Friday's game, I'll just read the scores. We'll just let that stand alone. Friday's game, San Diego State wins 14-7. Now, that's a pretty high scoring game for Friday, but it's like, you know what? Anything can happen. But oh boy, strap in. Second game, San Diego State wins 19-18 in 10 innings. And this game was like 14-11 after three or something ridiculous like that. And then in the finale, San Diego comes back to salvage a game by a 16-12 score. Now, I'm just going to assume the wind was blowing out at 50 miles an hour. Like, I can't imagine any other scenario. Here's the ugliest numbers here. San Diego's pitching staff, an ERA of 13.50 for the weekend. San Diego State's 10.67. Not great.
So when I joked about this on Twitter, first of all, it's important to mention that these are day games. I think Friday night was actually a night game, but the rest were day games. And I joked about the score on Saturday on Twitter, and I got a text from an agent out there who reminded me that during the day, the stadium does play much more as a hitter's park than it does at night. It does have some pretty crazy day-night splits going on out there. But this was next level, and I have no answers for it. I really don't know. This was not the only place this happened. I made a couple football jokes already on Twitter. It's one of my favorite things to do during college baseball games. I shouldn't say one of my favorite. I enjoy making college football jokes during baseball games that get out of hand like this. I ripped off a couple of them on opening weekend. But I could have ripped off some more. There were a lot of football looking scores out there. And, you know, I don't know if that's just pitchers. You know, normally we see pitchers being ahead of the hitters. I don't know if that has somehow flipped in this strange season. I don't know if it's attributable to the defense that again, wasn't great around the country. I don't know if it's just the crazy weather led to some crazy winds. It's probably some of all of these things, but San Diego and San Diego State was definitely the most extreme example that we saw.
I'm interested to dive in a little bit, just a preview for listeners. I'm going to dive in a little bit on this, and my weekly three strikes feature is back. And I've only started just now compiling the data, but I'm kind of trying to take a look at how many double digit, just using an arbitrary cutoff of 10 runs, like how many double digit run scoring did we have over opening weekend, and then kind of find out what percentage of the games that was versus what it was like last year, for example, just because I am curious, because it did feel to me like it was a pretty high scoring weekend. And we've talked about some of the reasons, defense or just seeing a lot of different pitchers, which, you know, can go either way. So because maybe it's not on percentage basis, maybe it's not as many as you would think, maybe in large part due to the fact that you don't have like Northeastern teams traveling to SEC locales as much, or ACC locales or what have you, with pitchers that haven't really, you know, teams that just haven't been outside. So we didn't have as much of that. So maybe that ends up tamping some of it down. But long story short, I'm going to write that up for a little little nugget on my three strikes this week, and we'll find out together whether it was a lot or not as many as it seemed on paper, because it did seem like a lot.
So speaking of crazy offense, Joe, I'm a little surprised you haven't mentioned Florida Atlantic's Caleb Pendleton yet. He hit two grand slams in the same inning of his college debut on Saturday night. That in itself is just that's the tweet, as we would say. FAU scored one of the bigger upsets of the weekend, beating Central Florida in a series that split between Orlando and Boca. But Caleb Pendleton, a big time get for FAU as a freshman, and he only played in the one game this weekend. We'll see exactly what his role is going forward. FAU has a good catching situation, as they typically do. He's kind of the next one in line, but you know, he didn't get a hit the rest of the game either. So it was an incredibly abnormal performance, but absolutely fantastic performance, and one that I know he'll never forget.
No doubt about that. He pulled off what I like to call the Fernando Tatis. And for you youths out there, that's Fernando Tatis Sr.
I don't know who that is, Joe.
You classify as a youth in this situation. Two grand slams in an inning for Fernando Tatis Sr. Funny story about him. I had cousins who grew up in the St. Louis area, and they liked baseball and liked the Cardinals, but in a very casual way. Like they would, you know, they'd go to a couple games a year and they'd watch the occasional game on TV, but they couldn't tell you. Now, this is like the late 90s, early 2000s, beyond like Mark McGwire or Jim Edmonds, a little bit later on, Scott Rowland. They really couldn't tell you much about the team. But they happened to be watching the day that Fernando Tatis hit two grand slams. And so you had to kind of like, I remember having to like tell them like, no, actually, like Fernando Tatis is not like one of the best hitters in baseball. Like he's just, you know, he is not like the second coming of Mark McGwire here, but because they had watched that one specific game, like they had just decided that Fernando Tatis was like a Hall of Fame type of hitter. And there was no convincing them otherwise. So that's kind of become a little bit of a joke in my family that, you know, Fernando Tatis just didn't quite live up to their Hall of Fame potential they had for him. But
you heard it here first, Caleb Pendleton, Hall of Fame potential.
That's right. That's right. He's the next Fernando Tatis, which is to say a Hall of Famer. Yeah, a good weekend offensively for FAU. You know, I think I may have undersold what they could do offensively. Part of that, I think, is just I've become so hardened to the fact that FAU just hits every year. But they got a really good weekend from, you know, obviously Caleb Pendleton, heck of a game there. But Nolan Shanuel, another one of their newcomers, hit over 500 this weekend. DJ Murray is a breakout guy, a really good athlete, like looks the part, just hasn't put it all together yet. He had a really good weekend. The question, of course, is going to be pitching. Now, you know, if they're going to score as many runs as they did this past weekend, then they don't need a ton of pitching, but that is the bigger question. And so for as good as the offense was, they also weren't doing a lot to keep UCF from scoring. So that's really going to be the question moving forward. And I think their ceiling is largely, I mean, the offense controls their floor, because I think they're going to compete for a postseason berth because they can hit and because they typically find a way to cobble together the pitching. The pitching being any better than that is what controls the ceiling, and we're not going to know that until we get a few more data points under our belts here.
All right, just want to run through some stuff here quickly, and Joe, you can react to any of this stuff if you want once I get through some of it. Boston College swept Charleston Southern, which by itself doesn't seem like that big a deal, but considering how slow BC started last year, just getting those three wins on the board is significant going into ACC play next weekend. Clemson swept Cincinnati. That was a pretty competitive series despite the sweep, and Cincinnati is going to be solid. So that's a good one for Clemson. They have South Carolina this weekend in obviously a big rivalry set. North Carolina Central swept Army, the Patriot League favorite. And that on itself would be significant. But then when you consider that NC Central just a week before opening day anyway, got news that the program was going to be eliminated at the end of the season, just the emotional rebound there is massive. So definitely shouts to the Eagles for getting that sweep done. Samford goes 3-0 this weekend. That's a nice start for them. Duke goes to Coastal, wins a series. Not unexpected, but obviously that's going to end up being a really nice series win when all's said and done. It was a wonky series ultimately, but good on Duke for getting that series win. I know, Joe, you were interested in seeing what Louisiana Lafayette had this weekend against Tulane, and they come out with the series win. And then Xavier going to College Station and upsetting Texas A&M. Feels pretty significant. Xavier annually challenges itself in terms of early season schedules. Oftentimes doesn't come up with the wins. They usually only win like one of the games in the series and end up like much closer to 500 overall than their talent indicates. But this time they got it done down there, and now Texas A&M starting at 1-2. That's a tough one for the Aggies.
Yeah, and it strikes me that, you know, Xavier is probably better than, to your point, the record last year, for example, suggests. But it did strike me that that's typically the kind of series that even the A&M teams that aren't necessarily top 25 teams or potential top teams in the SEC West, that's typically the type of series that A&M wins those three games by a combined like 26-4 score or something like that. And so I'm not necessarily hitting any sort of panic buttons on A&M, but like that definitely is the type of series that they typically handle pretty easily, kind of like they did in the finale when they won 15-0. It's usually kind of like a weekend of that. So that definitely caught my attention there. So good win there. The UL and Tulane series was probably the closest series played anywhere this weekend. Like just razor thin margins in all three games. Really good news for the Raging Cajuns. I think it suggests that they're ready to be quite competitive in the Sun Belt. We'll see to what extent that's enough to you know, compete at the top of the Sun Belt. But certainly that was good news there. And even for Tulane, I mean, they put up some runs, and that was more the question with Tulane. So maybe you can even take some positives of that if you're the Green Wave, although you would have liked to have won that series in the end. Duke quickly liked what I saw on offense. Didn't like what I saw on the mound necessarily. Going to have to get more from Jack Carey and Henry Williams if they are going to continue to be the guys in the rotation. It doesn't necessarily, they don't have to be. Cooper Stinson was pretty good. So there was that. So questions to answer there for Duke on the mound. But again, like what I saw offensively, you know, I think Peter Matt did show that he can bring a level of physicality to the offense. You know, so liked that they were able to, you know, scrap together the runs they were there. So liked all that. And on Clemson's one of the more intriguing teams to me, and I'll kind of have my eye on them. Obviously this weekend, it's an easy thing to do because they have the rivalry series against South Carolina. But one of the questions I had about them is there another Sam Weatherly? And kind of what I've wondered is maybe it's Davis Sharp kind of taking another step in his development. You may remember that as a freshman, he was a nice arm, but he was, seemed like maybe he wore down as the season went on. He didn't really dominate. He was just kind of a solid starter for them. And last year appeared to maybe take a step forward, and we just never really got to see that fully come to fruition. Well, he puts together a good start. Opening weekend, one hit over five innings with 9 strikeouts. That'll certainly do the trick there. So you like that as maybe a piece of the front of the rotation. And the offense was good. You know, the offense, you know, hit nearly 300 for the weekend, but it's the guys you felt like maybe you needed to see take steps forward. You know, Bryce Teodosio with a good weekend and Dylan Brewer with a good weekend. Jonathan French with a good weekend. So it's a team that I still don't know. I think it's maybe a team closer to on the bubble than a team that hosts, but I think it's a team that certainly if you're going to tell me that Davis Sharp is going to be a big time ACC, you know, all ACC type of arm at the front of the rotation, which we don't know if he is, but certainly like what we saw this weekend. And then if the offense is a little more well-rounded, I don't know that there's a Seth Beer on this offense, maybe.
I mean, probably not. Just probably.
Yeah, I mean, like, easy to
given
easy
what
forget.
Seth Beer is.
Yeah, Seth Beer, one of the greatest hitters in Clemson history. Yeah, so that's pretty high bar to clear there. But if you're going to tell me there's a little bit more depth there and that maybe some guys, you know, whether it's a freshman like Caden Grice or if it's Jonathan French or if it's, Maybe it's Teodosio putting it all together. If maybe they've got one or two of those types of guys, I think it could be a pretty good offense and be a team that maybe is a little more safely off the bubble than I think. So that's a team I think I'm going to be watching relatively closely the next couple of weekends.
Yeah, absolutely. One more that I should have mentioned is UConn and UVA. We talked about that on the pod, and UVA gets a series win. But UConn looks solid. It was a weird opening game, more runs than I would have expected, settled down from there as a series. And Virginia, now the number two ranked team in the country. So look out for the Hoos going into ACC play. All right, we covered an awful lot of ground there. We could keep talking. It's just great to have the games back, like I mentioned at the top, to be able to talk about action that was on the field. But we're going to cut it off, and we're going to come back at you later in the week to preview the weekend to come, and if anything important happens in midweek, the few midweek games that are scheduled this week, we'll definitely touch on them as well. So make sure you are subscribed to the Baseball America podcast on your favorite podcasting app, be that Apple Podcast, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us there. Joe and I are on Twitter. I am at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy, BA, and there is plenty to read and will be throughout the week over at baseballamerica.com. So thank you again to Rapsodo for presenting the Baseball America College Podcast. Thank you to Joe for joining me as always. And thanks to you guys, the listeners. We're so happy college baseball is back and that you're along for the ride for the 2021 season with us. We'll talk to you next week on the Baseball America College Podcast.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you. With professional-grade industrial supplies, count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.